Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3, KPCG online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on today's program, President Obama has a sit-down interview with CNN, has some comments about race in America. We'll have some of those highlights for you. Also, parents, there's a warning about some of the texting codes that some teens are using. We've got some details about that. And Guthrie, Oklahoma, just down the road here, makes national news for a pretty bizarre story. We'll have that and other stories on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. There's a live link there at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Send out some links and even photos occasionally. Sent a photo out the other day outside the studio window. It was looking nice. And you can send us any emails you have to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon here today as well. And, of course, we're in the middle of a little bit of a cold snap here in the U.S. in general, and today was a day I was very glad to have a garage for my car because it's frosty. So if you don't have a garage, depending on where you are, you had to spend some time defrosting the windows.
I'm already getting tired of some days my windshield freezes over and then other days it doesn't, because just when I think after a few days of it not happening, it's not going to happen. This morning I was late for work. Coming out at like 7:55 and it's frozen.
Yeah, you kind of have to just, I guess, figure maybe it could happen. It seems like when there's a little, you know, a little moisture in the air, it'll freeze. And when it gets really cold and it's dry, it doesn't. And it's pretty dry, so I am surprised. But I did see a couple of cars that had some frost on the windows.
Yeah, it was annoying. I was just going to IA, though, so the kids got an extra minute at recess before the class started.
Better to be defrosted than to get into an accident.
Right.
Yeah, because you see that sometimes, too. There's other things going on as far as natural occurrences. Earthquake, actually. Earthquake magnitude 6.5 was reported 102 miles west of Ferndale off Northern California on Thursday, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. People as far away as San Francisco reported feeling the quake, but there were no immediate reports of damage. The USGS first reported the earthquake at 6:50 a.m. local time. And Ferndale is about 120 miles south of the Oregon border. So anytime there's an earthquake in California, people pay attention, especially when it's a big one. Thankfully, this one was off the coast a little bit. But that always gets the talk going. Is the big one coming? That's the question.
They've definitely been a cursed state over the last 30 years. So every kind of natural disaster possible, even unnatural disasters that are happening, California gets them all.
I remember when I was a kid, they had some special feature on television. It was about like potential natural disasters, and they had a map of the U.S. and they showed it like after the big quake that they thought was coming. And California was gone, and like the side, the coast fell off. So hasn't happened yet, but it made an impression on me. I thought, wow,
quite a scare tactic.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you got those faults running there, San Andreas and other ones. So. But anyway, kind of interesting there. Hopefully, no problems. We do have some listeners, quite a few listeners online in California, different areas there at kpcg.fm. So hopefully you're okay. They're used to it, though. I mean, if it's not a huge quake, it's not unexpected. So I guess they just go on with their day, kind of like we're doing nowadays here in Oklahoma, that we have so many quakes.
Right. I mean, as long as there's a road to drive to work, I think most people are fine.
Some of the roads around here, you don't know if it's earthquake damage or if it's just the natural
potholes everywhere
deterioration, because there are some bad ones.
That's what's frustrating about these roads is you can tell that the repair crews come in, they fill in the one pothole, but that's it. And then so there's all these different patches all over the road instead of them just going and repaving the whole thing.
And that, yeah, it becomes a road of just patches, patchwork road. And then you get a rain or something happens and it washes out the patch and then the hole's bigger than it was. You know, you'll be going one way and a car's coming the other way and you both have to kind of go in the middle to avoid bottoming out your vehicle. And you look at each other like, who's going to go, you or me? And usually you can work it out okay. Mm-hmm. People that have big trucks, they don't seem to care. They just plow over those things. But yeah, some bad roads. This is interesting from yesterday. Of course, it was the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And this story says, Admiral gets standing ovation for Colin Kaepernick remark at Pearl Harbor ceremony. Kaepernick's just barking up the wrong tree. At a ceremony in Hawaii on Wednesday to mark the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, U.S. Pacific Command Commander Admiral Harry Harris made a remark that was clearly about the quarterback. Didn't have anything to do with being sacked five times and throwing 4 yards. He said, "You can bet that the men and women we honor today and those who died that fateful morning 75 years ago never took a knee and never failed to stand whenever they heard our national anthem being played." The AP reported the comment drew a lengthy standing ovation from the crowd with people whistling and hooting. People don't like what Kaepernick's doing.
It's interesting because there's also been a few service men and women who have seemingly gone rogue from the common consensus among them that and they say that it's fine to kneel and that it's not showing any disrespect at all. But that has to be the vast minority there.
I think so. I saw some pretty good news stories last night about different ceremonies with some people that are actually still alive that were there, you know, and there's not too many of them left, but there were a few even here in Oklahoma City. And, you know, when they'd start talking about it, they would say, like, it was just like yesterday, like they remember it all. And they'd be quite emotional because in a lot of cases, the people they were talking to in these interviews were helping people, you know, bringing them out of the water. They couldn't save everybody, but they saved what they could. And it's still, the one guy said, I think it was here in Oklahoma City, he said he used his bed sheets to wrap up the people that were coming out of the water. And he says to this day, every time he gets into bed or whatever, he thinks about that. And he started, you know, tearing up because of how traumatic that was. And you see people like that, that really sacrificed and it had such a huge impact on them. And then you have some young quarterback who doesn't know anything about anything trying to talk like he's the expert. You know, you weren't there. You weren't in those situations. And it'd be wise to maybe learn from the elders and just be quiet about it.
Mm-hmm.
Learn from the history maybe a little bit.
Right, and a big part of his complaint is that black people like himself are being treated poorly. But the thing is, he's not even really a black person. So that's another critique that people have is that he was raised by two white parents. He's half and half as it is, so shouldn't he lean more to the white side anyway?
Yeah, he's trying to make it a racial issue, and that's not even really, I don't think, what any of it's about. But that is a topic that happens, that comes up occasionally in this country, more now than it has in the past, I think, at least in recent years. And CNN had this interview with President Obama, and they talked about race and a couple of his comments here. He said, the president said, "I think there's a reason why attitudes about my presidency among whites in northern states are very different from whites in southern states." He says, "Are there folks whose primary concern about me has been that I seem foreign or the other? Are those who champion the birther movement feeding off of bias?" Absolutely. So that's a pretty sweeping statement about a wide swath of the population. How could you prove anything like that? That's just an inflammatory comment, I think.
Yes. What you could say is that vast swaths of the North actually vote Democrat, and maybe that's why they approve of him in the first place, and vast swaths of the South vote Republican, and maybe that's why they didn't approve of him. But once again, we have to make it about race and him feeling otherized, which is one of those terms like triggering now that we have.
Yeah, and it gets out there in the media. The article says that during his presidency to try to deal with race issues, Obama responded by delving into law enforcement practices, creating commissions, and issuing recommendations to police departments for how to treat suspects and handle volatile situations. He took steps to reverse the high rates of incarceration among African-American men, including granting clemency to hundreds of people convicted of nonviolent drug crimes. They should say not violent yet, because they typically become violent. And he instituted the My Brother's Keeper mentorship program for young black men, a mission he says he'll continue when he leaves office. It says, but those efforts haven't improved Americans' view of race relations in the final days of Obama's presidency. A CNN survey in October showed 54% of Americans believe relations between blacks and whites have gotten worse since Obama became president. 57% of whites and 40% of blacks held that view. And so it's interesting to just talk about some of the things that he did. Were any of those helpful? I mean, you have to look at the fruits. Were they helpful? Was it helpful to interject his opinion into the law enforcement to let people out of jail? I don't think that's been helpful at all.
Right, and it's hard to believe that the police departments across the country would be in favor of him intervening the way he has. I mean, that would be like an artist coming up here into the studio and telling you how to run the radio station or telling you how to edit TV footage. I mean, that's not their job. That's not their expertise. And they're going to try and tell you what to do. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, especially when you're on the ground as a officer, I mean, you're dealing with things all the time. And to have, you know, even in the situations that were very big public media situations, the Trayvon Martin, et cetera, a lot of the media anyway, and sometimes the president, were very quick to come out and make a very strong statement. And then what happens later? You find out, well, it really wasn't like that. There wasn't this big injustice that they said there was. But too late, it's in the narrative for, you know, Black Lives Matter and some of these other movements. And so to just interject your opinion without getting all the facts, it's just very dangerous. And I think that's why the relations are worse today.
Well, right. What's happened the last 8 years is that we assume that the criminal is some innocent victim, and that's just never how it is. The police are not just out there prowling and looking for people to shoot. That just makes no sense at all. And yet, for some reason, we rush to judgment against the police on the other side.
And releasing, as they call them, low-level drug offenders, well, that's just going to increase the drug usage. Because if you know, well, they'll be back on the street doing the same thing. And if you know that there's not going to be a major penalty, well, then people will do it. More people will do it. The way you get rid of the problem is you enforce a stricter penalty, because if the penalty is not severe, then why would anybody stop? So those things haven't worked. He has one last comment here. The president says, if my voice has been true and positive, then my hope would be that it may not fix everything right away. Mission successful there. He said, that's okay. We plant seeds and somebody else maybe sits under the shade of the tree that we planted. I'd like to think that as best as I could, I have been true in speaking about these issues. And I think he's been true to his opinion about them.
He is planting seeds. It's just a matter of what kind of tree springs up.
Absolutely. Yeah, he is planting seeds. And he has been true to his opinion, but it's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
His opinion is, this is what should happen, or this is how police should do things, or this was a wrong situation, whatever, you know, situations he got into. That's his opinion. He was true to that. But was he true to the actual right and wrong of it? Not very often, I don't think, at least in the things that have been major media situations or stories, you know, coming out in some of the comments that were made. The survey shows, it hasn't helped. And you have to look at the fruits. I mean, the words are fine. People say a lot of things. Has it made things better or worse? And they've gotten worse. So I would say it hasn't been successful trying to get the races together.
Not at all. I mean, we keep trying to make everything about race in this country. Why not just deal with criminals of any color like criminals? It doesn't bother me when a white criminal gets in trouble, gains the punishment that he's deserving for committing that crime. We shouldn't be thinking about the race of the criminal.
Yeah, it should be about law. If you broke the law, well, that's the, you pay the price for it. Technology, of course, is always changing, and it's hard to keep up with all the new ways of using technology. And the young people always develop their own lingo. They always have something new to say. We were talking about that yesterday, the expression, throwing shade.
Yeah.
You know, new expressions all the time. And I think with people that are older, and I find this as I get older, it's not that I couldn't know what it means. I just don't care.
Yeah, it's not worth the 2-second internet search that it would take to figure that out.
But sometimes you do have to kind of be up on what the words mean or what the codes mean, because you got to watch out for your kids' sake. This is from CBS New York. It says, parents advised to be on a watch for teens texting codes. So, of course, they've realized, well, we want to communicate certain messages. Our parents might look at it. We got to have a code so they don't know what we're saying. This is pretty high-level stuff here. They say if you want to know what your kids are texting about, sometimes reading the message is not enough. And they have this video for the story here. As CBS2's Dave Carlin reported, teens often use abbreviations to hide the meaning of their conversations. And there are a lot of new ones that you might not know about. And they have a list of some. I'm not going to get into what they are because they're very inappropriate. But you could go find the article, or I'm sure you could Google it if you want to know what the kids are doing. One of the ones that he mentioned, though, and this one's a little more benign, but it still is important, I guess. They say that when they text a solitary number 9, that means parents watching. So now, of course, the code will change, I'm sure, between now and whenever. But that's what they, you know, hit the 9 quick. Then everyone knows, oh, parents are watching. We'll change our conversation. So all kinds of these codes meaning some very inappropriate things.
Wow. Yeah, that just shows you codes are really only necessary when someone is doing something below board. So, I mean, there's codes for all different types of things, the drug trade, pedophilia, all types of codes. And this is just another one. Teenagers are very smart. That's one thing that we know.
They will, they'll figure out a way to get their messages across. It reminds me of when I was the number 9 for parents watching. It reminds me of when I was in grade school. We used to play football in the playground, and school rules were you couldn't tackle, no tackling. So our rule was it's two-hand touch when the teacher's there, and then it's tackle when they're not.
Right.
That, we made that up amongst ourselves. But there'd always be the one kid that didn't see the teacher. And they would just, the teacher would start watching and we're all, oh, two-hand touch. And the one kid would just blow the other guy up. And the teacher would be, you know, whoever the guy was. Let's just call him Bill, you know. Bill, get in here. And he'd have to sit in for the rest of recess. And we're all all laughing like, you should have seen. You know, and they try to explain it to the teacher. Like, well, everyone's doing it. And they're like, I don't want to hear it. So
that was the same with recess for us, too. I just stopped playing. It's just, I don't want to hurt somebody, so.
Sometimes you get caught in your own codes, your own web, web of destruction. So anyway, it is an interesting write-up, and I think it is important because a lot of teens have smartphones and they are texting, and like you say, there's not codes for good things. No one's trying to hide good things. It's for the bad stuff that's going on.
Right, and with texting, it's easy to go back and print off actual messages that your children have sent, so that the record would be right there in front of you. That's why they have to use different codes to get away with things.
You know, there's been a lot of stories lately too in the news, just really, I don't know, this seems like this didn't used to happen as much, but it is happening now, where it's being reported where some high schools and things, there's relationships between teachers and students, inappropriate ones, and in every case it gets back to the smartphone. Mm-hmm. They're texting each other or they're sharing images or something. And I have a smartphone. It's very handy. I like it. I'm an adult. But, you know, there are dangers there, too. You have to be responsible with it.
Right. Yeah, a lot of the time, teachers will give out their number to the students just so that the students can ask a question on homework, but it could easily escalate.
It's happened. It's strange stuff. You ever watch that show, The Biggest Loser?
Yes.
Yeah, where somebody's way, way overweight, and then they come in, they try to help them out, and pretty radically change their lives, and they do lose weight. I mean, you kind of can't help it, but we've talked about this before. A lot of times they gain it back after the show, and the Biggest Loser winner, Allie Vincent, you might remember her from a while back, a few years ago, 2008, I think. She recently came out with some interviews, and she's gained it all back, sadly.
Oh, no.
It's a decade later since she won, and almost a decade, I guess. And she's gained just about 112. That's what she lost on the show. So it's a tough thing, and I think it just highlights some of the extremes in U.S. society where people are so extremely overweight, and then they're going to go on this extreme diet and this extreme workout regimen, and they're going to lose extreme weight, and they gain it back. And how about just some moderate changes? I mean, it'd be great to never get to that position in the first place, but how about just some moderate changes and be consistent?
Right.
Not much of a show if you do that.
Exactly. Well, the thing is with that show, a lot of the time they'll go back and they'll look at where those biggest losers are now. They'll go back 5 years on the show and say, well, this person won 5 years ago what's their progress like? And a lot of the time they have gained the weight back, and the viewers can easily think, well, they must have just been sitting around and eating all the time and to gain all the weight back. But really, when you cut 200 pounds or something like that in the course of however few weeks it is, you've actually made it impossible to sustain that, because you'd have to work out like 9 hours a day to keep the weight off after you have sped your body up like that.
Yeah, life gets in the way again. You can't continually live on the ranch or wherever they are.
Because that's all they're doing all day is working out and meticulously monitoring their diet. They don't have time to do that in real life.
Right. So it's a sad thing. It'd be very demoralizing, very frustrating. They should make a new show called The Moderate Loser.
Right.
It's like a decade. It takes a decade, and you're like, yeah, I lost about a pound last month.
That's healthy. That's a reasonable thing too, because you know, losing 100 pounds in 6 weeks or whatever it is, if you lost 100 pounds in 5 years, that's a good thing. I mean, that's more reasonable and possible for the average person to replicate.
Yeah, it's and I think it puts a false idea in people's minds when they're trying to lose a little bit of weight, and you know, because you can't lose 20 pounds in a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not normal. You shouldn't. You'd be pretty sick if you did, because
mm-hmm.
There's fat store a lot of toxins, and you release all that into your body. It's not a good deal. So anyway, it's just some of the extremes in our society, but and it's sad too, because you know, they got their ratings out of the show. That's what they wanted, and then the person, you know, too bad, you know, see ya. Not sustainable, sadly. If you need to buy a new car and you don't want to spend a lot of money, here's the three cheapest new cars in the U.S., starting with the third cheapest. $14,000, under $14,000, you can get the Chevy Spark starting at around $13,875. So these cars, and they say they're decent. I mean, they have decent warranties. You know, you could expect, I would assume, 100,000 miles, at least, I would hope. And it's not like it's cheap, but, you know, when you see some of the the price tags, especially if you're buying a truck or something, you know, $50,000, $60,000. So these are not those. These are just the quick get-around cars. The Mitsubishi Mirage, $12,995, if you can find one. The cheapest, the Nissan Versa. You can get one of those for $11,990. And so for a brand-new car, it's not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
They say they're not bad vehicles.
Wow.
They'll get you around.
So that's not even been driven yet.
Right.
Wow.
Brand new off the lot.
Impressive.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times if you go and you buy a used car, you're going to spend that at least. And sometimes they've got 60,000, 70,000 miles already. Mm. Now, these aren't the ones that are probably going to last the longest. But you know what's funny? Sometimes they do. It's just weird.
Yeah.
You can't even go by necessarily brand. I mean, you sort of can, but there's always that odd, like, oh, yeah, they've been driving that car for 500,000 miles, and it's like this old whatever it is. I think a lot of it has to do with how you take care of it, what you do with it. Those, they can last.
Yeah, I have a really old, beat-up Toyota Corolla that's probably almost 20 years old, maybe, and it has probably close to 300,000 miles on it,
wow.
But just keeps going.
I think, it's like sometimes you know people get too old to die. They just keep living.
Mm.
Cars are the same, right? They just keep going. You're like, it shouldn't be going anymore, but it just keeps going. Not well,
right.
But it keeps going.
Yeah, poor car. They just have it just rattles all the time. I have to really be careful to avoid potholes with that car because the whole thing could break right there.
Well, if you hit the pothole just right, you might get a complete engine rebuild.
Or I might get 5 feet of air. That's another thing.
Yeah. I've seen that car driving around. You always know when that one's coming. Those Corollas are good cars. They last a long time.
They really do. Yeah. That's one of those cars where, I mean, we've broken the door handles off probably 10 or 15 times of that one car, but it's just cheap plastic, but it doesn't mean that the engine doesn't run well, because it does.
Right. You have to like do a Dukes of Hazzard thing with that. Weld the doors shut, take the windshield, the windows out,
right.
And just slide in and out through the... Be some good exercise. Try to keep your trim. You can't get in and out of the car anymore. So, you know, of course, this next one happened. And this is a hometown story here. We made the national news. Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Nice.
So you can hear us over the air down in Guthrie there. Maybe these people are listening in today. If you are, you should be ashamed. Sweet Tooth leads police to home burglary suspects. They say a good detective looks for any piece of evidence to solve a crime. As it turns out, home burglars left Guthrie police a treasure trove. The Sergeant Anthony Gibbs says, I'd have to say this is the first time candy wrappers have been significant in solving any type of crime that I know of. They had a sweet tooth when they went in to rob these people. They stole some guns and a safe and a few other things, quite a bit, actually. And they say it all began in the historic neighborhood in East Guthrie, which a lot of us are familiar with, when the victims left their home for the weekend. In the alleyway behind the house, the police found the drag marks from the gun safe that they stole as they dragged it to where they are. And then they also discovered a trail of candy wrappers reminiscent of Hansel and Gretel. In all, they found 8 blocks worth of Kit Kat and Reese's wrappers. Not just one. Multiple. They scattered them as they walked and ate their candy and dragged a safe full of guns.
Wow. Well, they could probably be arrested for just as long for egregious littering.
That's right. That littering fine will be worse than the burglary, the invasion there. They say the wrapper trail continued after they dropped the safe. In fact, all the way back to their house. So they got a search warrant and recovered most of the stolen property. And they said it was sweet justice.
That's just unbelievably dumb of the criminals to do that.
Can't you wait till you get back home to have the candy? Did they bring it with them? Did they steal it from the house? What happened?
Just put the wrappers in your pocket. It's not that hard.
It'd be interesting to be the detective in the case or whoever's involved and be like, well, yeah, you shouldn't have broken in. That's a terrible thing, and you're going to pay the penalty. But I got to ask you about the candy. What were you thinking with the wrappers? There's a lot of questions that need to be answered there, and I want answers.
It really is like a 5-year-old stole the safe.
Maybe it was some teenagers or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, really interesting story. Here's one other one. This is a seasonal story, I guess. Santa Claus fat shames a 9-year-old boy. This is making the headlines today nationally. This is where we are in our society. Sometimes this time of the year, people like to take their kids to the mall, and they sit down there and get pictures and so forth. Well, they did that with one kid, and while he was sitting there, a North Carolina boy said that the noted cookie lover, referring to the, of course, guy dressed up as Santa, decided to dispense diet advice suggesting that the boy lay off the hamburgers and french fries. And the kid's pretty big. He is a big boy, so... He was very offended by this. His name's Anthony Macy, and he walked away in tears. He said, it affected me so bad that I was crying until I went to bed that night. I think that's an exaggeration. He said, I would say to him, like my mama said, you don't want to disrespect a 9-year-old. I've never heard that. Is that an expression that's common?
Sounds like.
Well, you know, you don't want to.
What kind of generation is this where everyone, now I sound like I'm 70 years old.
Yeah.
Seriously, everyone is crying themselves to sleep at night over books that they read in class or what Santa tells you, which is actually very helpful advice, by the way.
Best advice you could have got. The kid said, even though, or he said, what shape and size you are, it doesn't matter.
It kind of matter, and you need to be fat-shamed.
It does kind of matter. And the key said when he went to apologize to me, he didn't even mean it. So, I mean, I get, you know, you don't want to, you know, make fun of the kid, or I don't know exactly what happened here, but just the fact that they're coming out now and being so outraged about it, the guy saw the video, and the kid could stand to lose a few. I mean, yeah. I don't know, what does he want people to do, like pretend that that's not the truth of it? Yeah. Not saying this is a way to handle it, but at the same time, well, you know, I mean, my scale fat shames me all the time. I get on that
exactly.
thing. It doesn't tell me what I want to hear. Can I sue it? I don't know. Sue the scale-making company?
Well, the kid would be pretty well off to just stop being a wimp, and his parents should stop encouraging him to be a wimp.
Yeah, that was just a strange, strange story. You got to be careful what you say, and you can get called on the carpet for it, I guess. anyway, one of those interesting stories. That's another new expression, the body shaming. People are being shamed.
Mm.
Well, and no one's ever happy. You see all the headlines, like even today, like under this story, they had a bunch of stories kind of like this. And, you know, a model was body shamed because she lost too much weight. And then another one, you know, the back and forth. And
right.
Then somebody writes an opinion piece, and I'm sure there's a doctoral thesis on it. And I don't know, just try to eat well, move around a little bit.
Well, a big trend now is to try and put 300-pound women as models on the cover of magazines and things like that, where you just try to make it look like obesity is completely normal. And basically what fat shaming is saying, well, that's not normal, and all you need to do is try to be healthy. We can't present this image that this is the kind of body that is ideal.
It's always an interesting topic when it does come up, and it
can be, obviously it can be offensive, but that's what people need to hear. They can't be tricked into thinking that it's okay to be obese.
It's just health issues,
yeah.
Besides anything else that come up, so it is kind of interesting. The Key David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. A couple of programs for you today. Make sure you listen for that, and then also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. A lot of information today about Europe and what's going on over there, and talking about a lot of Bible prophecies that talk about what you can expect to see happen in Europe. And it's a very tumultuous time in Europe. Things are changing. Brexit, the immigration issues, the vote in Italy. There's probably more than that. Those are the things that come to mind. Mm-hmm. But a lot of things changing over there. And so, of course, the election of Donald Trump, that's a big one because that makes them a little more antsy, I guess. They feel like the U.S. is more isolationist. So make sure you listen for this Trumpet Daily Radio Show and get the scoop on what's going on over there in Europe as well. You ever hear of the Pet Rock?
I forget what it is, but I've heard of it.
It's popular. Well, I don't know if it was. I guess it was popular back in the maybe late 70s, early 80s, where people would get rocks and then just put a face on it and give it to somebody. I actually received one. It was a disappointing day. you know, and they say, here's a pet rock. And, you know, the thing is, even as a child, I thought, well, there's a bunch of rocks outside. I mean, I could just go grab one. Like, that's not, why is this a thing? But so somebody, you know, they would sell these. It was like one of the greatest money-making gimmicks of all time, you know. So it's kind of making a weird sort of comeback. Nordstrom's $85 leather-wrapped rock sold out online. So Nordstrom's is taking it to the next level. They're putting the rock inside of a leather pouch. I'd take the leather pouch, I guess, leave the rock. But it's $85, and it's sold out online. People want it. And it says an $85 leather-wrapped stone. Yes, you read that right, it says. Has sold out at Nordstrom's online store after going viral on social media. A smaller version for only $65. That's the one you want. Save yourself the bucks. For the budget-conscious rock lover is also out of stock, so those are both gone. The description says a paperweight, a conversation piece, a work of art. It's up to you. A waste of money? It's up to you.
A waste of money? Definitely.
It's it says it goes on in over-the-top detail. This smooth Los Angeles-area stone, wrapped in rich vegetable-tanned American leather, secured by sturdy contrast backstitching, is sure to draw attention wherever it rests.
It's obviously weird that that's even a product, but the fact that it's sold out, that stands out even more.
Yeah, it does. It's really surprising. There's rocks all over the place. They're not in short supply.
No.
You can find them really anywhere. You trip over them. And yet they're selling them for $85. I don't know. Is there going to be a lot of disappointed people that are going to get that from somebody and say, hey, I thought about you. And you get the leather thing. You're like, oh, what's in here? And then, oh, did you take the present out? Because this is a rock. Somebody put a rock in here. No, that's the gift.
They're still calling it a pet rock, too?
I don't know if it's called the pet rock anymore. That might be copyrighted. Oh. But it's a rock in leather, that's for sure. Really strange. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We're online here at kpcg.fm with our live link at thetrumpet.com. And we'd like it for you to follow, like for you to follow us at Twitter at kpcgfm. And you can send us emails to comments@kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk. Grant Turgeon's here, and Abraham Blondo has stopped by. And what I must say is a luxurious-looking sweater.
Thank you.
Is that yours? Well, it's yours, obviously, I hope. But is that a purchase you made, or did your wife buy it for you?
It was a gift.
Okay.
That is really tremendous.
Thank you. Yeah, I started
coveting it when you walked in.
I think people are trying to tell me I need to up my sweater clothing game. Yeah, so this was just the first step.
And I was going to get you a rock and leather.
But I'm sure I could figure out a way how to wear that, too. So,
what do I do with this thing?
I could use it to throw out your windshield when you drive by next time. So
I would appreciate if you didn't. Yeah. Yeah, that's how it's re-gifted, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't like the gift, apparently, as they threw it back through my windshield. We could give it to that monkey or that orangutan was throwing the rocks.
Yeah, because Ginger the orangutan was born. Right. To me, that's the untold tragedy in the story, is that a zoo actually named an orangutan Ginger. Do you think the civil rights warriors would be all in, up in arms about that? Not a word.
You don't like the name Ginger? What's with Ginger?
Well, nothing wrong with the word Ginger.
It's
but
an insulting term for people with red hair.
Yeah.
Oh, is that what it is? Oh.
Yeah, and orangutans have like the reddish.
Oh, I gotcha. Hair.
That,
I,
that is bigoted.
I didn't put those two things together. Well, no wonder she's throwing rocks. That's what she's mad about.
Yeah, exactly.
The injustice there. Now, we need to take a deeper look at that. Interesting story you've got here for us here, and this is always sort of a complex, I guess, issue about Syria. Syrian army retakes Aleppo's old city as rebels discuss exit. I think everybody knows, obviously, there's a war in Syria. It's been going on for a while. Who's doing what in that region is a little bit vague, I think, to probably the casual observer. And they've got a pretty good map here where they kind of they illustrate like who's controlling what regions. Maybe to begin with, you could give us just a refresher on who's doing what in the Syrian region.
Sure. Yeah. So the Syrian civil war has been going on since 2011, and it's been very destructive. And it's been a seesaw battle between many different types of groups. It can be complex, but there are four main groups. Combatants in the arena. That's the Syrian army under Bashar al-Assad, the U.S.-backed rebels. There's a couple different rebel groups, but the main backed ones allied with the U.S. You have the Kurds, Kurdish fighters who are involved, and then you have ISIS, which is like a fourth party that isn't allied with anyone
right.
involved in the struggle. And Aleppo is a very strategic city. It's a big city, but it's in the northwest corner of Syria. And it's strategic because it is near the border of Turkey. And so it's a area that guards the northern passages of Syria. And so Aleppo's been under battle for a long time. It's basically a modern-day siege by the Syrian army, loyal to Bashar al-Assad. Besieging parts of the city that are held by the U.S.-backed rebels. And the Kurds are also in the battle as well. But they're not... they have their own nationalistic intentions. They're not exactly fighting for the same thing.
And then we've got Russia, which is backing Assad.
Correct.
But sort of fighting ISIS?
Yeah, it seems like Russia will bomb ISIS once a month just to keep up the facade that's why
but
they're there.
But they're propping up the Assad regime pretty well.
Yeah, they provide Assad with surgical airstrikes, military advisors, and hardware and on some occasions.
That's right. So you've got the U.S. backing the rebel groups, Russia backing Assad. Russia and the U.S. both kind of fighting ISIS. So you've really got all these proxy wars there too. What a mess! Yeah, what a mess. And so in this particular write up, they're talking about how the Syrian army, Assad's army, has retaken Aleppo's old city. So they're making gains there in this strategic area.
Yeah, and the old city was one of the strongholds of the U.S. backed rebels, and this is a major turning point in the war because. If the U.S. rebels have to leave Aleppo, there's a good chance they won't be able to recover permanently. And so this could be a big turn of momentum towards Bashar al-Assad's forces to regain control of most of the country. He still has to deal with other forces, such as ISIS, in the nation. But this is reconquering Aleppo could be a big strategic victory, but also a prestigious victory because it is such an old city with a lot of historic buildings in it, and it's very important to the history of Syria. And so
it's amazing how Assad has hung on, isn't it? I mean, he looked like he could be toppled for quite some time, but now it seems like he's sort of gaining or, you know, in strength. But really, obviously, it's the other bigger powers that are coming behind the different sides that are keeping him around. Like Russia, and I guess Iran is supportive of him in some ways as well.
Yes.
So it's interesting when you look at the Arab Spring, the nations that fell, Gaddafi, Libya, and Egypt, they didn't have like Iran's backing, right, as far as I understand it. But the ones that Iran does back, does support, and Russia helps too, they're still standing, I guess. Iran being one that they didn't fall, obviously. Syria being another one. And so it's just interesting to see like where the real power is there, because they're getting their way, even though the battles keep going on and there's ups and downs. At the end of the day, people they want to stand still stand, and everybody else has fallen. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is, with the benefit of hindsight, to see how the Arab Spring more or less empowered American enemies and removed allies and didn't really find a replacement for any allies that we lost, really, in the region. And so it is it was a dangerous development as we look at it now.
And we knocked off our allies.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you would say Gaddafi was an ally, but he was kept in check from, you know, his experience with Ronald Reagan and some of what happened there. So he at least was a known evil, I guess. And so we took out all those people. And, of course, Mubarak there in Egypt was an ally. And so we just went in and made a good mess of it and let Iran come in and other powers.
Yeah, what's interesting, too, to reflect, especially with the Syrian civil war, is that when the Arab Spring happened, President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, they were all behind this democratic revolution. They were willing to invest American money and resources into this change. But when a chance came to remove the worst dictators, so Gaddafi, I mean, he was a terrible man. Mubarak was a dictator, but he... not to the same level as, I think, Assad or the Iranian regime. And when the chance came to remove Assad or the Iranian Islamic power, that the U.S. backed down. And I think what's interesting, too, is in 2011, when President Obama backed down from the red line, I guess it was 2013, sorry, when he backed down from the red line, that opened the door for Russia to come in. And they just, once the U.S. refused to invest military power, Russia said, like, well, we can move our military forces in because the U.S. won't be there. And so that's really what they did, especially when Assad was on retreat. We actually had a legitimate chance to remove him from power, even though we didn't really have a strategy on what we were going to do afterwards. But now with the support of Russian power, Assad's the most powerful man in Syria again and looking to reconsolidate his power in the region. And so I think it's... what's happening in Aleppo here with the rebels possibly having to retreat just epitomizes the failure of U.S. policy to back up what they said, to use our own resources. And we've barely helped the rebels anyway. They say we're allied with them, but we barely give them weapons, very, very little funding. And they're the ones who are being blasted by Russia. And we're allied with Russia in Syria, but we're not. And so we're allowing Russia to go and use their more advanced weapons to wipe out these rebels in Aleppo, and the U.S. isn't doing anything about it. In fact, we're talking with Russia about a ceasefire. And so I think this story here is tragic, what's happening in the city as well on a humanitarian level, but on a bigger strategic level, this is almost like the final nail in the coffin for U.S. policy in Syria. And it's going to leave a big mess for Donald Trump when he comes into office, to see what exactly he's going to do in Syria.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I guess if he kind of holds true to this isolationist sort of idea, you just come home. Say, well, we can't afford it. You guys figure it out. But, of course, that gives the region to Iran and Russia. And pretty interesting, which, of course, if you've read The Trumpet over the years, trumpet.com, that's you know those powers are rising. And Iran is talked about as the king of the south there, and they're just getting their way every single time. I mean,
you think they'd be more thankful, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking,
we paved the way for them.
I know. I was thinking about how, you know, they've been so wanting to give Iran nuclear weapons with this deal. Well, they don't want to, but you know that's what's going to happen. Sorry,
maybe they do want to. Who knows?
Who knows? But I mean, they want to allow them to have nuclear power. Well, imagine if we had done that to Libya, like gone there and said, hey, we're going to let you build these. People would have been like shocked, I would think, right? But with Iran, somehow, it's like, well, yeah, it's fine.
Well, it's the ironic thing is that Syria was trying to develop nuclear weapons, and Israel bombed their nuclear facilities and stopped that. And then Syria also has they've used chemical weapons several times. They still have chemical weapons. In fact, ISIS, during the Battle of Mosul, which is actually also happening now, ISIS moved most of their chemical weapons into Syria, into their territory, the little territory they have left there. So Syria and Syria proper and the areas held by other groups, they're still full of chemical weapons. And so it's still a powder keg. And of all the leaders in the Middle East, Assad's one of the most dangerous ones, akin to Saddam Hussein. He uses brutal methods to subdue his people, but then also uses try to get nuclear weapons, and then is using chemical weapons on his own people. That's something that needs to be stopped, more so than any other leader we can, almost any other leader we can look at in the region.
It's a mess over there, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. But this is the latest development. Syrian army retakes Aleppo's old city as rebels discuss exit. That's Washington Post, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, they have a nice map there if you want to take a look at that, because it's nice to see a map and kind of get an idea of what, who's doing what, but boy, confusing. It's just all the people involved. Grant, you've got an interesting article here from the New York Times. Political divide on campuses hardens after Trump's victory. Both sides, I guess, are sticking to their beliefs and not coming together to be friends.
That's right. A lot of conservatives on campus here in America thought that maybe some of their views would gain acceptance, or at least they'd be tolerated a little bit more now that Mr. Trump won. But that's really not what's happening. There have been evening vigils on campus where I guess they light candles and they sway back and forth together and they utter some prayers to whatever gods they believe in.
Yeah, well, it's really, that's really, it's just interesting to see the divide continuing there and people acting like, I don't know. I mean, I've read comments from people, celebrities or, I don't know, people in the media. They said that when Hillary Clinton lost, they felt like somebody had died. Like, they're just devastated by this. And I don't know, maybe it's just getting more media attention because it's social media. But I don't remember in the past the losing side making that big of a deal out of it. I'm sure they didn't like it, but I just remember people kind of moving on. And, well, that's the way it went. But not this time, at least not so far.
No, not at all. This election was obviously a lot different, and classes were suspended the day after Mr. Trump was elected president, as if every single student at the university was traumatized and devastated that Mr. Trump won, which clearly couldn't possibly be the case all across the country.
Yeah, I'd imagine probably a lot of them didn't even watch it or know what even happened. Oh, no test today? Sounds great. I'll be doing whatever, playing video games.
Right. Yeah, it's almost like a lot of the university presidents as well were indicating that they were on the side of the liberal students, because we know that the university presidents now are pretty much almost all liberals. And so they even would send out letters that said, you know, we understand that a lot of you are fearful and afraid, and we support you, and we'll make sure that the values we hold dear still remain on this campus even after the election.
It's really funny because there are a lot of things in this world to be sincerely fearful of in the sense of danger. Mm-hmm. But this isn't high on that list. The candidate you didn't like getting in, that's not real high on the list. What we talked about going on in Syria, that's pretty high on the list. What's going on with Iran and their nuclear program, that's very high on the list. Donald Trump getting elected, I mean, it's big. It's a big deal. Certainly there is whatever the U.S. does, it affects other nations. But like this idea that they're personally under some sort of attack now, not accurate.
Yeah, I think it's a reflection too on just the intellectual mentality on university campuses, where it's almost like a dictatorship, where in a sense where and there's statistics to back up just how fewer college people believe civil rights are important, or who believe less in the freedom of speech, that sort of thing. There's lots of studies about that. But just how it doesn't matter what your political orientation is, or if you support Trump or not, the establishment, the liberal staff and presidents, they pretty much dictate the kind of message coming from your school. And basically, if you attend that school, you do represent that school. and they're creating that message for you. And it almost seems like a kind of intellectual dictatorship in some ways where, and I think that's true if you look at how they're teaching people about history and other courses where they're creating a narrative that's very anti-Trump, anti-conservatism, and a lot of anti-other things, which I think is pretty worrying to think about.
Yeah, and but even there, it's not like Donald Trump's all that conservative.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking about their values. The liberal values, what ones exactly? Like, just like lawlessness. I mean, he didn't run on any sort of like, we're going to get back to some sort of law and, you know, the uphold the basic family unit. And he didn't say any of those things. He just talked about getting out of bad trade deals and making some money. So, and then he took a shot at a few people along the way. But, you know, if their fear is that it's going to go back to this big conservative thing, I don't know. He didn't run on any sort of platform like that. He wasn't that conservative. Maybe fiscally somewhat, but that's about it.
Yeah, and even fiscally, he proposed a $1 trillion infrastructure plan that would probably make conservatives have nightmares while they try to sleep. So really, he is the most moderate Republican of all time, and yet we're afraid that he's going to start eradicating minorities. I mean, it just makes no sense. It's funny as well, though, because a lot of the conservatives on campus are now claiming that they need a safe space because they feel like they're being discriminated against.
I thought the campus was a safe space. Now you need a safe space within the safe space?
Well, it used to be a place for liberals only, and now conservatives are kind of turning that around. And even just conservatives daring to use the phrase safe space is sparking a lot of conflict.
They're going to use their own, the other side's rhetoric against them, I guess. So everybody just needs safe spaces. And just put them, and then the moderates can be in the middle and enjoy the rest of the campus. Just have a good time. The extremes can be in their little boxes.
Right.
Go to your safe box.
Yeah, it's sad that the campuses have to be like this. Apparently, in some of the campuses, at least before the election, there could be some banter back and forth between the two sides. But now that the liberals didn't get their way, things are serious.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I don't know, it could be kind of appealing about, say, a college or a university campus is that you could have some back and forth with the student, you know, different students and in your classes, and you could exchange ideas and thoughts. And that can be pretty interesting to you know, be part of. But when it's just a shouting match and, or, you know, no matter which side it is, there's no way the other side has anything right. You know, that's not healthy. Even, I know, like, say, the way they want to have their education happen is an exchange of ideas back and forth. That's kind of their thought on it. But they're not even doing that. So I don't know. They might as well just start making like schools that are just, well, and they kind of do, I guess, but you know, where it's like, hey, all liberals go here, all conservatives go there, and just split up and do your own thing and segregate yourselves into your own thinking.
Well, right. When the two sides can't coexist peacefully, it's almost physically safer to segregate the campuses like that. That might actually be the extreme to which we have to go. I was talking about some of these crazy presidential mass emails to the entire campus. The president of Amherst wrote, "In the mirror, we see virulent forms of racism, misogyny, homophobia, and other ills, and we see them celebrated by some as though the expression of our worst impulses were the definition of human freedom."
What mirror? Like a mirror on campus? Like a what mirror is he looking into?
Like, are they saying that we ourselves are homophobic and all these other things?
Yeah, it's one of those where you read it and you're like, wow. And then you think, what does that even mean, though?
Went way over my head.
Yeah.
It just, I can tell basically that this person is not happy Mr. Trump was elected.
I kind of lost him with mirror. I started thinking about Michael Jackson, that Man in the Mirror song. And I didn't pay attention the rest of it.
Right. Yeah, this, you know, presidents have highfalutin language, so that's
that was right to the delete box for all the students. Like, ah, junk mail from the president. I'd read his latest diatribe.
That's so funny.
You know, actually, if they did really like separate into different schools, that would be kind of fun when it comes to sports. Mm-hmm. You get the big clash between, you know, two schools and the liberals versus the conservatives, and that'd be must see TV, I guess.
Yeah, well, the liberals would just, if they're playing football, they'd let the other team into the end zone because there can be no boundaries.
That's true. You can't step out of bounds. There's no boundaries here. And it would just be one sports team because you can't differentiate between sports or genders. So they would just be playing. What are you playing?
Every sport. Yeah. They bring out every type of ball, every type of
yeah, at one time. And if you get too close when you're defending, you have to go to your safe space. You can't be that close to me. You're microaggressing me with your defense.
It's just funny if you try to take liberal policies and apply them in every area. It just shows you that a lot of them don't work very well.
No, they don't. They're not successful. Yeah, I mean, anything that works well, you can look anywhere, anything, sport, just nature itself. There has to be some sort of a law, you know. Trees kind of grow like they grow. They don't all of a sudden start growing, you know, 10,000 feet tall and knocking airplanes out of the sky. It's kind of rules to the way things go, and
yeah,
whether you care for it or not, it's the way it works.
We can't in 2016, just because it's the year 2016, change laws that have existed for thousands of years.
Well, it's a fascinating time to be a student on college. I imagine most people just go about their business and they don't really get into too much. You know, when I went to school, it certainly was not an environment like today, but people just minded their own business and did their own thing, and I would think most cases that's what people would do. And mm-hmm. You're always going to get a couple that are holding a sign and yelling something, but as long as you're not blocking my car, I'll just go about my day.
That seems like it's usually the issue, is that the loudest ones are the ones we notice the most. There are tens of thousands of students, millions of students across the country who are not necessarily making their voices heard or making people's days worse by forcing their opinions on others.
Yeah, but it is an interesting situation. We just, like we talked about, whether it's racially or ideologies, just more and more division in the country, or at least just being highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some of the things that are going on in this world today. Thanks for joining us on today's edition of Trumpet Radio Live, and make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, also coming your way later on. Thanks for joining us here. 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.